This is File 17. Today's date is February 12, 2016. This is Jean McMillan. I am interviewing Richard Paddock, who's going to talk about Taconic and the Scoville family, his family, railroads, and anything else he can think about. And we'll start with the genealogical information.
Okay, Jean, I'll give you the
genealogy stuff
you want. I was born in Hartford.
Well, let's do it by questions.
All right, you can do it. Whatever way you want.
What's your name?
Richard Paddock, P-A-D-D-O-C-K.
And what is your birth date?
April 12, 1947.
And where were you born?
Hartford. Hartford Hospital. Yep.
Okay. Your parents' names?
Charles Paddock and Elizabeth Paddock.
And her maiden name was Trust?
Trust.
With an E or without an E?
Without. Just like you spell it.
Okay. And you're a proud only child, right?
Correct.
All right. Educational background?
I graduated from East Hartford High School in East Hartford, and then my college education was at MIT.
And you got a BS?
I got a bachelor's degree there.
Okay. Now, I'm going to ask you how you came to the area, and then we're going to start with your grandparents and go through the family.
Okay,
so
fine.
How did you come to the area?
How I came to the area was, of course, that I summered here. My grandfather lived on Taconic Road. He worked for, at the time, Orlena Scoville. And we came here every summer. And the reason we could do that is the Scoville family had given my grandfather an acre of land on the channel portion of Twin Lakes.
And why did they give him an acre of land?
It was for 25 years service. And the Scovilles were inclined to do that. My grandfather was not the only employee who got land on Channel Road.
Do you know some of the other employees?
Jules Rebillard, Harry Smith, and William Reed also got property on Channel Road.
How do you spell William Reed?
R-E-I-D.
Well, there's R-E-I-Ds and there's R-E-Ds.
True, and William and his wife Hazel were the head of the Reed family that's now pretty prevalent
yes.
in Salisbury. Donald Reeds and Darren Reeds.
Yep, okay, all right. What was your grandfather's name?
Charles.
And what did he... How did he come to Taconic?
The story of how he got to Taconic is one of these pieces of serendipity that you often hear about. My grandfather, at the time, was working for a gentleman named John Ames Mitchell, who resided in New York and Ridgefield, Connecticut. And Mitchell went to Europe for the summer. And in the summer of either 1919 or 1920, Mitchell went to Europe as usual. And, of course, that meant my grandfather had no job. He was laid off. And Mitchell gave him a letter of introduction, which he used with Herbert Scoville, who was also in New York at Taconic.
Mm-hmm.
And he came to work the summer months while Mitchell was abroad for the Scovilles. It was just a temporary job. And the key element that landed him the job was he was experienced in the care and feeding of a car called an Owen Magnetic.
Now, that one I haven't heard. An Owen Magnetic.
An Owen Magnetic.
What was special about the Owen Magnetic?
It was a hybrid electric car.
Okay.
And in particular, it used some kind of an electric transmission.
Right.
The only one I know about is Jay Leno has one.
Mm-hmm.
It's operable.
Yeah.
If you go on the web and read about it, it's a pretty crazy car. And so it has electrical and magnetic components in it, in the driveline. And my grandfather could operate and maintain an Owen Magnetic, and Herbert Scoville had one.
Ah, key point.
Key point.
Okay.
Because I imagine that chauffeurs' experience with those things were fairly scarce.
Yes, having done many, 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 many car museums, including the one out in Reno, Nevada,
mm-hmm.
I have not ever seen or heard of an Owen Magnetic.
As I said, the only one I know of that exists is in Jay Leno's collection, so
okay.
We really can't zip downtown and look at it.
All righty.
So that got my grandfather to Taconic, and the other event that just happened was that John Ames Mitchell passed away before he came home.
Oh, dear.
Leaving my grandfather jobless,
mm-hmm.
and the Scovilles kept him on.
Oh, good.
And it did turn out well. And at the time, my grandfather was a widower. His wife had died in the 1917 influenza epidemic, which nearly wiped out his entire family. His wife and three of his four children were also killed in the flu epidemic, leaving only my father, who was being cared for by one of my grandfather's sisters, his aunt. And so my grandfather's straits were kind of dire. I mean, here he was a widower with
child.
An 8-year-old boy.
And no job.
And no job. So the Scobles were really the White Knights. They rescued him. And at that time, you know, being he was a widower and that my father was in the care of his aunt, Charlie was able to go back and forth between Taconic and New York with the Scobles, and he did that.
Ah, okay.
So ultimately, my father went with him, and but we're a little bit ahead of that story.
Okay.
Until my grandfather remarried, my father stayed in Ridgefield with his aunt.
Now, did your grandfather meet his second wife?
He did indeed. The other thing that happened to him in the employ of Scobles is there was a young woman there named Suzanne Magnuson.
How do you spell the Magnuson?
Magnusson.
I got it right.
And Susie was an immigrant. She had been brought over from Norway, but she made an intermediary stop. She lived for a time in Glasgow, Scotland. So the English that she learned had a Scottish tinge to it. And she was brought over, essentially, I'm not sure what her title was when she was hired in, but her duties were essentially a nanny.
Okay.
She took care of the young Scoble children. And the two met and ultimately married. So Susie became my father's stepmother.
Was there a tremendous age difference between Charles and Susie?
No, it wasn't a huge difference. I mean, she was younger than him.
A few years, but not 10, 12.
Nothing significant,
okay.
No. And at that point, when they got married, as the Scobles went back and forth, Charlie and Susie took my father to the city, and he went to school in Manhattan during the school year, and then he came to Taconic for the summers.
When did your grandparents that you knew marry? And Charles.
They married about 1925.
Okay.
Now, nature took its course, and Charlie and Susie had a daughter. And at that time, they asked the Scobles if they could stop the commuting back and forth between New York and Taconic and please stay in Taconic. And the Scobles accommodated them, and they stayed. They gave them a house to live in, which is adjacent to the carriage house in Taconic.
Okay.
And that became their permanent home once my Aunt Lois was born.
And the daughter was Lois.
Yeah, the first daughter was Lois. They had a second daughter named Shirley, two girls. And, of course, my father was quite different in age. And so he was the big brother to the two girls.
Well, that's good.
Yeah. And my father then, now that they were resident of Taconic, he went to high school in Salisbury.
Your father?
Yeah.
Did he go to the Lakeville High School?
Went to the lower building, what's today the lower building.
Okay, but that was
Central.
The high school.
That was the high
that
school.
That became the high school in 29, and that was the high school for 10 years, and then it was the regional.
Exactly.
But he went to the lower building, which was the Lakeville High School.
Exactly. His class picture was taken on the steps of the lower building.
Okay. I know it's a small detail.
Well,
but if we're trying to slot things in,
it gives you a sense of where they were in time, because Lois, on the other hand, his sister, was in the first all 4 years class at Regional.
Mm-hmm.
She didn't go to school at Salisbury Central. She went to elementary school in Taconic at the Taconic School, and then she was in the first class that did all 4 years at Regional.
Do you know if she had Laura Johnson's mother at Taconic School?
I believe she did.
Which would have been Mrs. Holmes.
Mrs. Holmes, yeah. Connection there.
But it's important.
And probably Dean Hammond was there in that school. I know Dean went to that same school, so okay. There were some other people that are in the history archive that mm-hmm. went to that school.
But I didn't ask him about that because I didn't know about that. I asked him about yeah. the Ragamuffin.
Well, I have a few recollections that Lois shared with me about that school, but I've heard them and other people talk about it, so it's well covered. But okay. It was a building that the Scovilles built.
Because I was going to get you to that, but yeah, do it now.
We'll do things when we get to them.
Tell me
about
it now.
The Scovilles built that school for the community as an exchange. When they built the mansion on Beaver Dam Road, there was one of the town schools was there.
That was the first one on Beaver Dam Road. The first school was at Beaver Dam Road.
Yeah, it was on the top of the hill there, where the Scovilles house is to this mm-hmm. day. And they wanted that land, so they made an offer to the town, said, if you'll give us the land, we'll build you a new school. And the town took them up on it, which was certainly a good idea. The school in Taconic was designed by the same architectural firm that designed the Robert Scovilles house. So this was a professionally designed building. It's got a stone ground floor and a wooden upper. And it had two classrooms in it that were divided by a movable partition that came down the middle between the two. And then there was a wing out to the back of it. The building was shaped originally like a letter T. And the stem of the T had the bathrooms in it and a library. And there was room in there so that the kids could conduct activities during the colder months. And it was surrounded by a playground. And there are a number of old pictures of it that kind of show the layout. And the today it's completely forested around that structure.
Oh, it is now.
But it was originally out in the middle of an open lot.
Did the children bring their lunch, or did they go home for lunch?
Probably some of each. I think that a lot of that depended on the time of year.
And how close they were to the school.
And how close
yeah.
they were to the
okay.
school.
Okay. Because I've been doing something on Grove Street School, and Mrs. Senior, Lila Nash's mother, lived across the street, and the kids would trot over to her mm-hmm. house, get their hot lunch, and bring it back to the school.
I never thought to ask Lois and Shirley that, but since they lived with less than a mile from school,
oh, they walk.
In that era, walking that distance oh, would, yeah. would not have been an issue.
Did the Scovilles provide electricity for the village of Taconic,
well,
or just their own?
Not life? the whole village. The way it evolved is in about 1903, the Scovilles decided they wanted to electrify the two houses. There was Herbert Scovilles' house and Robert Scovilles' house there. Now, one of them's on Taconic Road, the other on Beaver Dam. They're not that far apart from one another. And apparently it was really in vogue in those days. People of means wanted electricity. Mm. It was the newest, neatest
oh, yeah.
thing.
Oh, yeah.
And they put in a hydroelectric power plant to power the two mansions. And some of the other structures on the estate were powered. But not that they did not power the entire area.
Now,
the system was an Edison system, and part of the problem with powering a large area was an Edison system. It generated electricity at 250 volts DC, and that form of power will not carry through much of a distance.
So it has to be converted.
So, you know, that was the big, that's the reason Edison lost out to Westinghouse, was that DC just doesn't go for miles and miles and miles, and there's nothing you can do about it. AC, on the other hand, you can use transformers and extend the range indefinitely. In this case, the main power was given to the two mansions and some of the ancillary structures. Obviously, the power supply itself, the electrician's house, the guy who ran the power plant got electricity, and a few other buildings there got electricity, all of which was done underground. The cables are probably still in the ground. But that was amazing for that era. They did, in most places, they just nailed the wires to trees.
Oh,
Scovilles
yeah.
buried them.
Now, Herbert Scoville lived on Beaver Dam Road.
Correct.
In Hill House.
Right.
Robert Scovilles lived in the Stone House.
Stone House.
On Taconic Road.
On Taconic Road.
I'm learning.
Yeah.
Now, your grandparents have... We finished with the grandparents, have we? Can we go on to your father?
Sure.
Okay. Your father went to school in Lakeville.
Right.
What did he do for higher education after high school?
Higher education was, again, we come back to the Scovel family. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. The children of all the employees got scholarships from the Scovels. And Annie Angus writes about that in her memoir.
We do have that.
In her memoir, she mentions that. So I know she went to college on a Scovel scholarship, and my father didn't. It wasn't really a college. He went to a 2-year school for electrical. Mm-hmm. And in those days, electronics was a 2-year thing. It wasn't a 4-year degree. So essentially, it was a 2-year engineering school called Bliss Electrical School in mm-hmm. Tacoma Park, Maryland. And so he went there, and he wanted to do things electrical, and when he returned, he worked with a guy named Ellister Patchen, a.k.a. Chet Patchen, in Lakeville. And yep. apparently he had a radio shop.
He did.
And my father worked for him, and he also did wiring. He wired several of the Scovel houses, and he did some electrical work at Hill House. And he wired the big farmhouse on Hammertown Road also.
That Grasslands farm?
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah, the big house at Grassland.
Okay.
Because he talked about how the corner posts of that house are 14 inches square oak beams.
Oh, Lord.
And he said, there's a lot of my drill bits still in that house.
Oh, sure.
They just broke off.
Oh, sure.
Yeah.
Oh, that's hard wood.
I can only imagine.
Okay. And now we get to you.
Yep. My father left town. He had wanted to work for IBM. But remember the era he graduated from school. It's the Depression.
Right.
So jobs are not easy to find. He had an uncle that was employed by Chance Vought Aircraft in East Hartford.
What's the name of the aircraft? Chance?
Chance Vought.
How do you spell that one?
Chance is the regular spelling, and Vought is V-O-U-G-H-T.
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 Okay.
Chance Vought ultimately moved out of East Hartford to Texas, but at the time my father went down there, his uncle got him a job at Chance Vought, and he worked there a few years, and when they moved, he was able to get his job at IBM.
Ah.
So he fulfilled his dream. In the meantime, he was rooming with the family that rented space to his uncle. His aunt and uncle lived on the second floor of a duplex house, and the landlady and landlord had room for rent on the ground floor, and they also had a daughter, and you kind of know where this story is going to go.
It wouldn't happen to have been the daughter was Elizabeth Trust, would it?
It would have been exactly what the case was. So the uncle leaves with Chance Vought, and Betty and Charlie get married and move upstairs. So I grew up in a duplex, mm-hmm. over under,
mm-hmm.
with Grandma and Grandpa downstairs, which was a really nice arrangement for an only child.
I grew up in a duplex. We started downstairs, and then when I was 5, we moved upstairs, and my grandmother lived in another house just across the backyard.
Yeah.
So I understand totally.
So all I had to do to visit Grandma was go downstairs.
Yep.
Which, kids will do that all the time.
And that's fun.
Well, it also worked out because since I was born, I've been a morning person.
Mm-hmm.
My parents definitely were not morning people. They loved to sleep in.
Mm-hmm.
Every Saturday morning, I had breakfast with Grandma.
And that's good.
I have wonderful memories of that. The two of us had a lot of time together.
And that's important.
It is.
It's very important because it carries on the family background
mm-hmm.
and traditions. And
She was an immigrant, so I had a lot of time to hear stories about how she grew up in Europe
mm-hmm.
and what her life was like growing up in the second half of the 19th century in Europe.
Yeah.
In the advent of modern technology and Google Earth and all that sort of stuff, I've been able to visit electronically the town she was born in, which is today in Hungary. It was Austria-Hungary then. And I have to admit, if I lived there, I'd have moved away too. It's still not a place you really want to linger.
Yeah, I can imagine. Yeah. I can imagine.
Let's just call it a humble town and leave it at that.
That sounds like a plan. Is there anything else that you'd like to add about the Scoville family before we move on to railroads?
Well, I think you could tell from what we've said already, the Scoville family's generosity was singular. I mean, they were just wonderful people to work for. And it wasn't just my grandparents.
No, it was others.
They were good. And as I grew older, and you hear more and more stories, I mean, that my grandparents represent the tail end of the Victorian era.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
And you hear a lot of stories about brutality between the householder and the employees.
Not
and
in the Scoville family.
And mistreatment, and that's just not the way it was here.
Not in the Scoville family, and not from all of the various people that I've talked with over the years.
Especially, so I've done some research. I know several of the current generation of the Scoville family. And I got interested in the family. I mean, they played a big role in, you know, my mm-hmm. grandfather's life and,
sure.
and my father's life. And certainly I now live on that piece of land that they gave my grandfather, so they steered my life as well. And I always wondered how they got here and stuff, and I can't tell you that story, but I have researched them. And it's interesting to note that another pair of brothers, Jonathan and Nathaniel Scoville, left Salisbury in the 1860s thereabouts.
Yep, yep.
To conduct their business. They had a foundry. They were in the iron business, yeah. which ran in their family.
Mm-hmm.
But even though they were gone, you know, yeah. in fact, one of them became mayor of Buffalo, so that they mm-hmm. participated in their adopted community. You still, if you read Judge Warner's memoir and other things we have in the town, those Scoville folks just keep popping up here in Salisbury. They left, but they didn't leave.
Scoville Memorial Library.
For example.
Jonathan Scoville left $12,000 in
yeah.
his will to have a library built.
And you know, there was there's a renovation project, I think.
Oh, yes.
St. John's that has Scoville.
Yes.
And the Scovilles were involved in the chapel in Taconic.
Yeah.
So
yep.
they were in Buffalo, but they weren't in Buffalo.
They were benefactors to many people
yeah.
and in various locations.
And they weren't vocal about it.
No, very quiet. Very
the
quiet.
The Scoville Library has their name on it, but a myriad of other things they gave the town don't.
True.
So, fascinating family. I finally figured out how they made their fortune in the iron business in Buffalo. And I had to kid Tony about it. I knew where the foundry was, and he didn't.
That figures.
But, you know, that happens in families. As,
oh, yeah.
as time passes, you lose touch
and
with
as
the past.
As they get more spread out
yeah.
with more descendants.
Well, the Barnum family doesn't know anything about their iron heritage either. So, mm-hmm. you know, I can't hold that against them. Fascinating family.
Oh, yeah.
And played a big role in Taconic and in Salisbury's history.
All right. Now we're going to talk about choo-choo trains.
Choo-choo
the
trains.
The railroad.
Now, during the 50s and part of the 60s, remember, I'm a summer kid on the lake every summer. At that point, the trains still crossed.
Oh, yes.
There were trains to Lakeville. They weren't terribly regular, but there were trains. And they crept across that causeway at the south end of the West Lake. And, of course, that's where we are. We're on the channel. So the West Lake is kind of the area I was familiar with as a child. And you really couldn't miss the train going across because the sound of there was a diesel engine,
yeah.
and that throb of the engine echoes up that lake like crazy. So you know when a train's coming. And we'd see these trains go across there, and I became curious, you know. I said to my father, well, why is there a train track there?
Mm-hmm.
And then he talked, well, that was a railroad, an east-west railroad. There used to be four trains a day each way. And I used to hear the whistles at night in my bedroom. And summer nights with the windows open, I could hear the trains coming through. Now, of course, the house he lived in was probably only a few hundred feet from the station. Maybe at most a quarter mile.
Yeah.
So you bet he'd have heard steam locomotives coming through on a summer night. And there's a hill coming from Salisbury to Taconic is uphill.
Yeah.
And he recalls particularly that the trains would sometimes slip coming up that.
Mm-hmm. Because of the grade,
and they'd have to pour the sand on, and you'd hear the rhythm of the engine really change.
Yes.
And then it would go back to chug, chug, chug as the wheels bit in and it came up the hill.
When did the trains first come to Taconic?
I got interested in it and started asking questions. So now I've found out a lot about that railroad. The original railroad was called the Connecticut Western Railroad. Mm-hmm. It was completed in the late fall of 1871. So the first train started going through Taconic, then Chapinville, in 1871. Rail service to the general area was much older than that. The railroad reached Canaan in 1841. And the reason for that is that most of the railroads that existed in the second half of the 19th century in Connecticut went north and south. And the reason for that is deliciously simple. The level ground in Connecticut runs north and south. You don't have to travel very far east and west anywhere in Connecticut before you start going up and down.
Right.
In the late 1860s, a gentleman named Egbert Butler, who lived in Norfolk, his house is still there.
Edgar?
Egbert.
Egbert.
Egbert. Got the idea that an east-west railroad would be really cool. He would start it in Millerton, and he would pick up the Housatonic Railroad. Well, he'd pick up the Harlem there in Millerton. He'd pick up the Housatonic in Canaan. He'd pick up the Naugatuck in Winstead, and he'd pick up the Canal Line in Hartford. So he would stitch together all these north-south railroads with an east-west connection, and it would give local businesses in the northwest corner access to the Hudson River, access to the Connecticut River, access to Long Island Sound. It sounded like a great deal. And it probably was. The problem was building a railroad over all those mountains.
Mm-hmm.
The other thing that impeded him a little bit in the era, in that time period, if you wanted to build a railroad, you got a charter from the state you lived in, which meant that Butler could not build into Millerton. He could go as far as the state line, but if he wanted to connect to the Harlem Railroad, somebody who had a charter in New York was going to have to put the other 2 or 3 miles in to hook to the Harlem. And he found a co-conspirator by the name of George Brown, who had built a railroad from Dutchess Junction to Millerton. And it ended on Dutchess Avenue in Millerton.
Okay.
And it was a pretty simple matter. I think they had to build less than a mile of track to get from where Butler's stopped to where Brown's began. And they built a big freight yard, which is today...
Oh, that's the railroad plaza.
The plaza where the firehouse is in Millerton is the old freight yard. I believe it's called Century Boulevard.
Yeah, it is. It is.
But that nice big space back there is actually an old freight yard.
Oh.
And the Millerton station was near one end of that. So that gets you now the rail connection.
When was the rail connection?
So the first train ran on the 21st of December, 1871.
Yeah. And then when did the Butler and Brown connection come along?
Well, that was the celebration of their completion, December 21st, 1871. It led to a kind of a peculiar situation, is that the trains from Connecticut had to go a little bit north at State Line, and they backed into the Millerton station. There was a structure at the State Line called a Y, mm-hmm. because it looks like the letter Y.
Oh, yeah, I know what a Y is.
And when the trains were going westbound from Salisbury and Lakeville, they would go onto the Y and then back into Millerton.
Right. What happened to Chapinville in 1915?
I'm not sure I have the definitive story, but I know part of the story. I do know that the railroad changed the name of Chapinville Station to Taconic in the fall of 1915. The reason they gave for that was they had too many villes and too many long station names on their route. And they also had too many stations that began with the letter C. Now, to make sense of this, you've got to remember the communication in those days on the railroad was in Morse code. And Morse code consists of character patterns for, or dot and dash patterns for each letter. C is a long pattern. It's dash, dot, dash, dot. And there was Chapinville, Collinsville, and several, Cherry Brook, and there were a lot of stations that began with C's. So you've got to send a long letter first, but the C tells you nothing, so you've got to follow it up with another character. And an H is four dots, so you've got another long character. And similarly, an O is three dashes for Collinsville, so they wanted to do away with these and get short calls. Well, let's look at Taconic. T is one dash, and A is dash dot. So together, TA is shorter than the letter C.
Sure.
That's got to be appealing, because remember, the speed at which you send these characters over the wire determine how much information will pass over the wire. It's a bandwidth issue. Well, in these days, bandwidth is pretty scarce, and they want to keep the traffic over the line running trains and making money with telegrams. They don't want to waste their time sending call signs.
Right.
So that was their motivation then to change all these names. They changed East Canaan to Allendale, and it begins with an A again. And that didn't work, by the way. The residents in East Canaan said, we don't care. However, the next year, 1916, the post office is still Chapinville, as far as I can tell. And I was curious to see if the, the Lakeville Journal or the Connecticut Western News contained some kind of a announcement, hey, we're going to change the name of Chapinville to Taconic. And in reading through both papers for the entire year of 1916, the only thing I can tell you is that the June dispatch from the correspondent in Chapinville was labeled Chapinville. I couldn't find any news from Chapinville in July and August. In September, it came from Taconic.
Ah.
So, sometime in the summer of 1916, the decision was finalized.
Yep. And it just happened.
And there was no hoorah about it. I don't know quite how the post office got changed and who decided to do that or why. But I do know, too, from an 1892 article in the Connecticut Western News, that the post office hated Vills also.
Ah.
And they also hated two-word town names, post office names.
Like North Canaan?
Like North Canaan. And because a few of the good women of Chapinville wanted to change the name of Chapinville to Berkshire Gates.
Oh, that would not fly.
And I'm lost as to where that came from, but that's what they wanted to do. And the post office told them in no uncertain terms, no, you're not.
Okay.
They just didn't want any two-word names.
Well, I knew that the trains came to the Taconic station because it was a resort for the summertime.
Well, Taconic, unique. I mean, Salisbury was also unique in that it had so many railroad stations.
Oh, yeah.
Salisbury had more railroad stations than any other town on that whole line. And the Twin Lakes area had Taconic, Twin Lakes, and Washining. So the Twin Lakes area had, in fact, three railroad stations. Now, Washining's it was kind of like a bus shelter. It wasn't a real station. There was no agent. But there was a shed there and a flag. And if you hung the flag out, the train would stop for you. And if you told the conductor to let you off there, he'd let you off there. But the Twin Lakes station, which was on Between the Lakes Road, was a real honest-to-God station. And, of course, Taconic was also a real station. So we had three railroad stations serving the Twin Lakes area. The one at Twin Lakes became intermittent. It was open only in the summer. But the Taconic station stayed open year-round. And it had a milk house, so there was milk traffic in and out of that station. And, of course, ice.
Yep.
Twin Lakes was a big source of ice. There were ice houses on the lake in those days.
Oh, sure.
And the trains were the way the ice got to market.
Mm-hmm. When did passenger service stop?
Passenger service stopped in the fall of 1927.
And when was the railroad lines
abandoned? The railroad really ceased to exist by 1938. But it was death by a thousand cuts. the first thing that happened was they took the track over the mountain from Norfolk to Winsted out of service. And for a while, the track into Norfolk was in service, and they used it for ski specials in the winter. And then that track got dilapidated, and they cut that off. So various pieces of the railroad lasted, and in fact, the one that lasted the longest was the stretch from Canaan Station to Lakeville, which lasted until 1965. Okay. It was certainly, I can attest that it was not in good shape, but you could run a train on it.
Why did the train go to Canaan? Was it a junction?
Yes.
Or was it because of Borden Milk or iron? Or all three?
All of the above. I mean, okay. Canaan's your first junction point, yep, in Connecticut, so yep, you've got the Housatonic Railroad there that you can exchange. And to this day, there are two Y tracks,
oh, yes,
in Canaan, so that you can exchange traffic both north and south. Yep. If you take it north, you take it to the Boston-Albany, so now you've got a track into Albany, and you've got a way to Boston and Springfield. If you go south, you can hit Danbury, and ultimately that the Housatonic gets to Tidewater down at Long Island Sound. So that's a major interchange point for freight. And the next one over is when you get to Winsted, you have the Naugatuck Railroad,
right,
which gives you another path to Long Island Sound. It didn't go any farther north, but
it did go south.
It was a major interchange. Along this line, if you think about it, we have iron coming out of Salisbury and a lot of it out of East Canaan. The Barnum Richardson Company had a complex of tracks in East Canaan for raw material in, finished goods out. Their customers were people in Winsted, like the Winsted Edge Tool Company. The Collins Company in Collinsville was another customer, and they were all on the Connecticut Western Railroad. So the railroad hooked all these industries together and got the product from Salisbury and the rest of the Northwest Corner to market.
Well, I have done interviews where the high schoolers took,
yep,
the train to Canaan.
Oh, sure.
And they get on the train and come home on the train. And there were other interviews that talked about taking the milk to the Borden Milk.
Right.
Whatever.
True. Gail Borden, yep, developed his condensed milk process in this area.
Yeah.
I mean, it happened here. And there were Borden plants all over the place,
right,
but they were always on a railroad.
Okay.
And there was a milk plant in Millerton, and there was another one in Canaan.
Yes, there was.
Because I can remember the big chimney in Millerton was there up until, I think, the 80s or so. There was a big chimney,
yep,
there with Borden,
yep,
setting the bricks.
Okay. Shall we go on to the village of Taconic?
Sure.
Okay. We're going to start off with the Post Office General Store. Would you tell me a little bit about Frank and Muriel?
Sure. When I was growing up in the 50s and 60s, the store was operated by a couple named Frank and Muriel O'Neill. And they were certainly, I guess you'd call pillars of the community. Everybody knew them.
Oh, sure.
Because the post office was there. Muriel was the postmaster. And they had a gas station there, so you could get gas. And in the summer, you could get gas for your outboard. They sold outboard motor oil. And they had a pinball arcade for the summer traffic. So this is great stuff for a kid. I could walk to the store.
Oh, yeah.
I could buy a soda and play pinball.
Here, so what else would you want?
Exactly. And the other thing that they catered to was the camp. There was a camp on the north shore of the West Lake called Camp Everett, which provided a lot of customers for the O'Neills and a lot of amusement for the locals because these kids were city kids. They were from New York City. So they had very little country smarts. Most of them were, they were Jewish, and so they had an accent, a detectable accent. A lovely detectable accent.
Oh, yes, oh, yes.
And they gave us a lot of amusement. We would do things to kind of kid them along. And although I can't say we were, you know,
you weren't malicious.
Closely related to them. You know, we weren't malicious to them. We didn't prank them. But there wasn't a lot of interaction either. There was some, but not a lot.
Two different worlds. Two different worlds. Absolutely. Yep.
They were memorable in that they had this really dreadful PA system that they used to wake the campers up in the morning. And we would get to hear reveille played through this tinny loudspeaker, and then we'd hear all counselors on your porches, and then all campers on your porches. And
you knew the routine.
Yeah, you got to know the routine, but you got to hate that loudspeaker pretty. Yeah, you know, it wasn't a major disruption to your day, but you didn't welcome it.
No, that's true.
Because they played taps at 9 o'clock also. And we would see all these kids. You know, they had aluminum canoes, and you knew when they were coming because you'd hear the paddles clunking on the gunwales as they came. And a lot of times they were dressed up as Indians. And to hear Indians talking with thick city accents was just too irresistibly funny.
Oh, yeah. I'm assuming that this was a sleepaway camp.
Oh, yeah.
All right.
I think back about it now, and, you know, there was no mischief. These kids, for their pride, we didn't prank them. They didn't do things to us. They didn't vandalize anything or cut down trees or anything.
They were just there
having fun.
They were there having fun. They were probably doing nature studies and arts and crafts and waterfront activities and just enjoying it.
Yeah.
Because it was different.
Yeah.
Very different from the country and city.
So I don't remember the camp with any misgivings. I mean, it was there.
Yeah.
The loudspeaker was irritating. The kids were fun. That was about it.
How many buildings?
You know, I have no idea.
Okay.
But they had a lot of little cabins, which front porches on them, and that's where you had to go when the speaker said go on your... I guess you got a morning inspection on your porch. And it was on both sides of Twin Lakes Road. Twin Lakes Road passed through the middle of the camp, so there was an uphill side and a lakeside campus, if you will. The dining hall was on the upper side, which still exists and has recently been wonderfully renovated. So some memory of the camp persists to this day.
Good.
Some of the cabins still exist under new ownership. They're not in very good condition, but they're there. But there probably were a few dozen buildings between all the little camp houses. They had the dining hall. They had staff. They had a huge recreation building that was a couple stories high and had a basketball court in it. And they had a shower room, which was furnished with lake water. I can remember.
Oh,
there was a big sign in there that said, do not drink the water.
Okay.
Which, you know, a kid from the city might do that.
Well, they wouldn't know the difference.
They don't know it's lake water. Well, that's what the sign told them. This is lake water.
Okay. I'm going to go back to the O'Neills for a minute.
Yeah. Well, the camp plays into the O'Neills because Muriel catered to these kids.
Mm-hmm.
And one of the things she did, which the two things I remember the best, is she had a suite called Halva, which if you're a Jewish kid from New York, I guess you'll like that. It's like sweetened sesame paste.
Yeah.
And these kids loved that stuff, and we thought it was pretty strange looking. And she also had yogurt. I saw my first cup of Danone yogurt in the 1950s. And I thought, what the heck is this stuff? It looks like sour milk. And somebody said, it is sour milk.
It is sour milk.
And I said, these kids are weird. They eat sour milk. I don't even know how the Danone truck driver found Taconic. But by God, Muriel got them in there, and they had yogurt for those kids.
Oh.
And they had candy for those kids. And they would run them down in groups of 15 or so to the store to buy their whatever they wanted. And run them back up the road. So the store, and the other thing Muriel did during the summer, she extended her hours till 9 o'clock. So the camp kids could come down up until then.
And play on the pinball machine.
Exactly.
And buy their.
And the littler kids didn't come. I think they cut them off at 7, but the older kids and counselors had another couple hours where they could come down.
She was a good businesswoman.
Oh, she was, because one of the things she did was she installed local young people as the clerk at night. So there was a good-looking guy there for the girls to come down and purchase things from.
Oh, sure.
Yeah, Muriel was very good. The store itself was the old-fashioned general store.
Sure.
And she had a deli, and you could get a sandwich, you could get cold cuts and cheese, you could get milk. And she had canned goods and frozen food, but you didn't shop for it.
Yeah.
It was on shelves behind the counter, so if you wanted a can of beans, you told Muriel, I'd like that can, you got it. Or do you have any frozen peas? And there were freezers variously located in the building.
Yeah.
Some of them you could see, some you couldn't. and she'd get the stuff for you.
What do you remember about the fire of 1971?
I wasn't here then. I was living in Kingston, New York at the time. But the fire of 71 was very creepy. The reason for that was that in that same fall, the O'Neills had retired. And, you know, they were both elderly by then. And you figure, good, you know, they've served their time. They've really been an asset to the community. It's time for them to have some time for themselves. Because you run a store like that, you're either asleep or at the store.
Yeah.
I mean, you've got no time of your own. And we figured, good, they can retire, they can do whatever they want. Didn't work out that way. Frank killed Muriel and then himself in a murder-suicide. We'll never know why. And right after that, the store burned. And, you know, it's just close enough to it to make you shake
Very
your head
creepy.
And say, this is creepy.
Did they ever come up with a reason as to why the fire started? Was it electrical? Was it arson?
I never heard a good cause for why the fire started.
Okay.
And then the Palcos rebuilt it. The business had been sold to Ed Palco. And they rebuilt it. The structure that's there today in 2016 is the building that they built in 1972. They tried to run the store after they rebuilt. The post office stayed there.
Mm-hmm.
But I don't think they were... They underestimated the amount of time it was going to take out of their lives to do it. It's my belief. And they just weren't up to it.
Yeah.
And you really have to love that business to do it.
It's like a B&B.
Sure. The other factor is by the mid-70s now, you've got things like Patco coming into existence. And it's very hard to keep a small store, especially in Taconic, when you think about how remote it is.
Yeah.
It's, you know, and they did have the gas station there, but that wasn't much of a draw either. And now you've got more of these environmental rules coming into play. So the gas station became more difficult to operate, I'm sure. So those were all factors.
Yeah.
I neglected to mention that the post office in the old store was just part of the store.
Oh, yeah.
It was not in any way sectioned off. I mean, the customers in the store couldn't really get to the mail, but there was no locked door between the customers and the mail either. And the post office was distressed about that. And Muriel had to walk through the post office alcove sometimes to get you your fried
Whatever.
Chicken or your frozen peas. So that door, even if there was the door there, it never would have been locked anyway.
Yeah.
It also meant that if you were in dire straits and Muriel liked you, you could buy a stamp on Sunday.
Ooh, privilege.
Yeah, you bet.
What do you know about Washini Woods Camp?
Very little. I know that after the Camp Everett stopped operation, another group took over. Washini Woods was on the lakeside. They didn't take over the up the hill part of the camp. They conducted their operation on the lakeside, and I don't know much about it, whether it was a day camp or a sleepover camp, but I think there may be some other people in the history that can talk about it.
The only one that I've come across was Tommy Payne.
Yeah.
And I gathered it was a day camp.
That was my impression, but I can't say that with any conviction, but I think it was a day camp.
I'll work on
that. And they simply used the cabins that were there and the swimming area and all that. You know, there was a lot of stuff on the lakeside.
And they used what was there, but
they used what they had, sure.
How about what we call a stone house as a community center? Tell me about that.
Okay, there's an old stone house at the end of the channel across from the dam. I don't know of anyone in town that knows exactly how old that house is.
Is that the Dutch?
It's a Dutch stone house style. It's built out of a slightly different species of marble. The marble that we have in Twin Lakes area, usually when you cut it out, and if you look at the walls along Taconic Road, it weathers to gray. The stone house is not gray. It's kind of a yellow color.
It's probably more like oolite.
Yeah. So it's a different stone,
yeah,
which makes the house stand out.
Sure.
So I can tell you that I worked for the owner of that in the summer of 1964. So I've been in the house before it was restored. And the walls on the ground floor are fully 3 feet thick. They're massive, to say the least. And the south wall of the house included a smoking oven and a Dutch oven. It had a beehive oven built into it. The restoration did not fully restore that, but some of the brickwork was restored when the house was redone in 65.
And you said it was used as a community center?
Now, at least at some point in the game, the Scovilles owned it. And they used it as a community center. They strung electric to it. And upstairs, when I first saw it, was one single big room. And that was the area they used as a community center. The ground floor was really too damp. It would have been moldy in there. So they used the upper floor. And at that time, there was no connection between the two floors, the upper floor and the ground floor. The only way between them was outside the building.
Oh, like the library.
Yeah.
Which is being changed.
But the second floor has a really nice fireplace in it, and it has, you know, big wide beam, wide plank floors. And so they did think they had dances and things like that in there. There was a piano. So it was used as a community center. As I remember, I found remnants of the piano when I cleaned the yard up in the summer of 64.
And this would have been used in the 30s and 40s?
Yeah, that's my impression, before World War II.
How about the Taconic Union Chapel? That was also used as a community.
Yeah, now in the 50s when I was growing up, it wasn't used.
No.
It sat there.
Yeah, it was disused and the town took it for back taxes eventually.
I don't know the story of its demise, but I'll take, if that's what happened, so be it. I'm not sure what the excuse for tearing it down was. At the time, people said it was structurally unsound, but the crew that tore it down would tell you that wasn't true. They had a heck of a time with that building. And there's a number of different stories about what happened to the bell. I do know that Jules Rebillard got, there was a pump organ in there, a reed organ, and Jules Rebillard got that and tried to restore it. It was not a spectacular little building. It was a little square building with a squat square steeple on it. But, from my point of view, it made a perfect chapel. It was a nice, simple.
It was. My brother-in-law, Henry Kiera, who was preaching here at St. John's in the 40s, 30s and 40s, used to preach there in the summertime.
Yeah.
And the plaque, the brass plaque that talks about the people that contributed money to build a chapel, that plaque is on the back wall of the sanctuary of the Methodist Church in Lakeville.
Mm-hmm.
I don't know how it got...
But I guess the Methodists were certainly...
It was a branch of the Methodists that...
Among those that used it. Exactly which congregation held title to the building, I don't really know. I know it was built by subscription by a bunch of residents.
And that's the plaque.
And the plaque details all that.
Yep.
And Laura Johnson had some wonderful pictures of activities they'd had in their Christmas pageants.
She was talking about Christmas pageants and plays, and that's where she was remembering as a community center.
And there was a carriage house out behind there on the little road that goes on the green there. For the whoever was preaching there could park his horse.
Yep. Hillcrest School for Girls.
Right. This was something I learned about. My father told me there was a school, he called it a school for wayward girls.
Actually, it was not.
Yeah, I've come to learn that, but that's what my father told me. I found out what I could about it in Annie Angus's memoir and some other things, but where I really got an education about it was I conducted a bus tour of Taconic one summer.
Oh, that was fun.
And the current owner of the school was on the tour.
Was that Sophia DeBoer?
Sophia DeBoer, yeah. And she knew a lot more about it than I did, and she was kind enough to clue me in. And then I started doing my own research. And found out it was originally a farmstead. The house the DeBoers own is a wonderful old colonial.
It was a Dwight Allen farm.
Right. And some of, again, the Scovels appear in this. The two principals in that were Orlena Scovel and Mrs. Haddon.
Maud Haddon.
And she, they, of course, split their time between Taconic and Manhattan. And so the phrase that they used for the kind of girls they brought up there were troubled girls, which I take to mean girls who had somehow appeared in court.
They were girls that had appeared in court. They were girls that were like square pegs in round holes, and they were girls that had horrible living conditions at home.
I at first was very suspicious, it being, you know, the second decade of the 20th century. I said, I know what a troubled girl is.
But it was not.
But it was not. It was not a place to shuffle off your pregnant daughter at all.
No.
Although one of the pictures I've seen, there is a pregnant girl in the picture, but she's alone. She's not among many more.
It was for girls between 15 and 22, and eventually, at least the camp became co-education, and it ended about October of 1942.
Yeah.
When the
Institute for World Affairs took over the site. Yeah. They had built, beside the farmstead that's on Cooper Hill Road, they built a wonderful brick building that's on Twin Lakes Road, a short distance away.
Is that the Schulte Mansion?
I don't know who owns it today.
Well, it was dedicated, if this brick thing was what you're talking about, it was dedicated in 1930 by Mrs. Alexander Schulte as a dormitory.
Yes.
But I don't know when it was built.
Clearly, probably during the 20s. I hope to find that out someday. But that was part of the school.
Yeah. And then there was Willowbrook Cottage?
Yeah, there was another, and I don't know anything about that one.
Okay.
But I know the DeBoers have a lot of pictures and some articles, so we've been able to uncover a lot about it, and we know now what the how it got to be in Taconic from New York.
Because of the New York probate and
well, it was because of Mrs. Haddon and Mrs. Scovel.
Well, they donated three parcels of land in 1919 for $1 to the New York Probation and Protection Association.
Yeah, and I think they were probably very active in New York in that society as
well. Yeah, I've got the folder here and the brochures.
Mm-hmm.
They're on the Board of Trustees, both ladies.
Yeah. So it's very clear they were the spark plugs that got that thing going and kept it going.
And I won't say it morphed into, but the property was eventually sold to the Institute
for World Affairs, which was very much up and running during my childhood.
And that would be in the 40s?
That was in the 50s and 40s. 60s. It lasted longer than that, but
well, it's still going. But it's not going there.
The Institute itself is still going, but not in Taconic.
What can you tell me about the Institute of World Affairs from your recollections?
I remember we had a lot of very interesting people there who were dressed differently. You could find women in saris walking along Twin Lakes Road, and you know, people who were obviously not run-of-the-mill Americans. They dressed differently. They talked differently. So it really gave kind of a world-class fair to Taconic. He had these really cool people from other countries here in the summer.
Oh, yeah.
And the locals could go to some of the events. They had some lectures and things there during the summer. The public was invited. I also remember during the 50s, probably more than one occasion, Eleanor Roosevelt was there for one or more of their programs. And that was always big news in the Lakeville Journal.
Did you ever see her at any of
those? I did not see her.
But she was there.
But she was there, yeah.
Oh, the story that I heard from Charles Cook was that Dr. Ralph Bunch and his son had been invited, and Ralph Bunch was going to give the keynote speech for something. And either before or after, he decided he wanted to paddle on the lake, and so he and his son went out in the canoe, and the canoe tipped over.
Oh, boy. Well, I know you'd see these folks, and they would go to O'Hara's, and they would walk up and down the roads. So, and
what was the purpose of the Institute of World Affairs?
The idea was, I think you could summarize, was world peace through communication. Mm-hmm. and they had seminars for one another, and I guess the whole idea was to get people from different cultures to interact with one another.
Which makes sense.
Makes sense to me.
Yep.
And the way they got to Taconic was essentially World War II. They began in Switzerland in 1924, and Switzerland became difficult to access after the outbreak of World War II, so they came over here, figuring Taconic would probably remain accessible, and it did.
Yep.
It certainly was. And I guess they didn't leave until the late 80s.
I believe so.
And they added on. They built, the structures are all gone now, or almost all gone. But they had a building up there with a traffic circle with flags from all the nations that were attending.
How many buildings did they build? A couple?
It wasn't that many. It was two or three. And they used the O'Hara Farm, too. The O'Hara Farmhouse was there. And since the property changed hands after the Institute, the subsequent landowners tore down the school building and the O'Hara Farm, too. And so a lot of that's gone.
Mm-hmm. Okay. Anything else that you want to add to Taconic Village?
Well, I'd like to mention the fact that it also was industrial.
Oh, please do.
At the end of the lake, there's a waterfall. Nowadays, you can't really see it. It's obscured by the landscape. But there's about a 15-foot waterfall adjacent to Taconic Road. And in colonial times, that's a precious thing because that's energy. So as early as the 1750s, remember, Salisbury begins life in 1741.
Oh, yes.
In the 1750s, we have industry there. There was a thing called Camp's Forge there, which was a bloomery forge. That's a forge where you make iron essentially by softening iron ore in the presence of a reducing agent and beating the slag out of it. You don't melt it, but you can make pretty good wrought iron with a bloomery. So there's iron ore on the lake where today's Salisbury School boathouse is. There's an iron ore mine over there. The school has been filling it in for years, and I think they finally succeeded. There's marble everywhere you look in Taconic, and of course in the 1700s there were trees everywhere you look, so you've got charcoal, marble, and iron ore. You can make iron. All you need is a little water power to power your blast, and you're in business. Well, there it is. It's all together there, right at the end of the channel. There was also a woolen mill there. The Washington Woolen Mill was built on that site, and they shared the water power. Now, in that era, the end of the West Lake was not at Taconic Road. There was a waterfall further upstream, which is now private property, and there was a brook that exited that waterfall and came down and fell at the 12-foot drop there on Taconic Road. There was the waterfall at the north end of the lake was probably not very high, a foot, 18 inches tops. So in order to extract the most energy from the water, you need a longer fall. And they had that at the end of the lake. About the mid-1820s, I'd love to find out the details on this, but in 1825, Horace Landon builds a blast furnace there. Now, blast furnaces consume a lot of water. Undoubtedly, the brook would not have been suitable. It would not have provided sufficient water flow to power the water wheel and the blast engine, which would have been a piston pump in 1825, not a bellows. And so what they did was they opened the waterfall up at the north end of the lake. When I was a kid, we called that little opening the bathtub because we swam there.
Sure.
But if you swim in there, you'll see the drill marks. You can see that this opening is not natural. It's man-made, and it was blasted through the marble to enhance the flow out of the lake into the brook. And so the waterfront that I have is now the flooded margins of that original brook. I suspect that the water flow was insufficient also to power both the Washington Mill and the ironworks. So while I can't tell you for sure that's what happened, I bet the woolen mill moved down to Salisbury at the time the ironworks happened. And so that's why we have Washington E. Mill on Factory Street in Salisbury when it's nowhere near Lake Washington E. anymore.
But that's where it started.
But that's where it started. And then Landon's Furnace, we had first thought that it had gone into blast in 1826, but Joel Cohen dug up an ingot that's dated 1825. So we'll take that as the beginning of service of the furnace at the end of the lake. And it lasted until December of 1897 when the pinion on the water wheel broke. And the company leasing the furnace at the time chose not to spend any money fixing it and took the blast stove up to New York and installed it over there in Chatham at a furnace over there and abandoned the Chapinville furnace. So it ran from 1825 till 1897.
It's a good long time.
It's a good long run. They made a lot of iron there. And they had rail service. When the Connecticut Western Railroad was built through in 1871, they built a siding from the Chapinville station right up to the end of the lake there. There was a single-track siding with a Y at the end of it. So there were boxcars sitting there at the end of the channel in the 19th century. It's hard to believe that now.
Oh, my word.
But, and there were, you know, carloads of iron coming in and charcoal and marble and carloads of pig iron going out. Mm. And the rails went right to the hearth of the furnace. Well, not the hearth, but to the loading bay. So you could bring a charcoal boxcar in and spot it right in front of the furnace and shovel the coal right into it.
Oh, my word.
It was very convenient for them. And the structure that's there today is the Scoville Powerhouse. The Scovilles purchased the iron furnace after it was abandoned, tore it down in 1899, and used that spot and the water power to build their hydroelectric power plant. So that building that's there today is the power plant, and it sits on top of the foundation of the furnace. The entire area around the end of the lake is loaded with iron slag. The woods down behind the old stone house and the power plant and the shore of the channel along Taconic Road is all iron slag. You know, it's greens and blues. And, you know, it looks like obsidian. But it's people who canoe down the channel get a surprise when they look at these funny-looking rocks along the shore. And the iron furnace is the source of all that.
Were there a grist mill or any other kind of industry that you know of?
The nearest grist mill, I don't think there was a grist mill at the end of the Twin Lakes, but there was one up at Sage's Ravine. Okay. You've got another waterfall there, which, you know, is on the line between Massachusetts and Connecticut, and that was industrialized as well. There was another iron furnace.
Oh, yeah.
And there was a grist mill, for sure. The other thing that was up there on Hammertown Road, which gets us to why it's called Hammertown Road, was the Harris Scythe Works. And the way you make scythes in the 18th and 19th centuries, you forge them, which means you hammer them. You take billets of iron, which were called merchant bars, and you hammer them into shape.
What were they called? Merchant bars?
Merchant bars.
I can't write that fast. Okay.
And so the Harris Scythe Works was apparently large. I've never been able to find any map. There are some vague descriptions of the number of buildings.
Very vague.
But they don't really help you understand how big it was. It's apparently a fairly large industrial complex. I can remember where the bridge on Hammertown Road goes over the brook. The brook is the same brook that comes out of Twin Lakes. When I was a child, there was remnants of a dam at that site. So there had been a dam there on the north side of that bridge and probably a mill pond. But it was all, you know, vestigial even then. And there's no signs of foundations or anything out there in that field. Nevertheless, there was a good-sized factory there, and they made scythes. And again, as I said, they made them by forging, and the machine that you use for that is called a trip hammer. And trip hammers are water-powered, and the artisans then heat the metal up and pound it into the shape that they want. Well, you're going to hear that hammering for miles around as these trip hammers just beat all day, and that's why it's called.
And all night.
Well, maybe not. Remember, they didn't have much lighting in those days. I don't know how much night work they did, but certainly they beat all daylight.
And that's why it's called
Hammertown Road. Not because they made hammers there.
No, I knew that. I knew that. I was just trying to tease you on that one.
Last question I have is, what are the civic activities that you are involved in?
Well, I found out that when you ask people questions and listen to their answers, you learn. And then people start asking you questions. And life being the way it is, I now find myself the oldest rat in the barn. So,
not quite.
Well, sometimes it's just, I don't have anybody, or I have fewer people to ask questions of now.
They're falling off the perch, I know.
Exactly. So, and now people are asking me questions.
A little scary, isn't it?
It is very scary. So I joined up, because of the interest that I have in history, I've joined up with the Salisbury Association Historical Society, and with another group that's a lot of fun called the Friends of Beckley Furnace. Anybody that knows any of the history of this area, and Salisbury in particular, knows the iron industry was a big deal here. And it was a big deal for a long time. And as I discovered in a lot of the reading I've done, the impetus to settle Salisbury was not the wonderful farmland that we don't have. It was the iron ore. That's what brought people here. 100 years after the colony of Connecticut got started, people found Salisbury because they wanted the iron. Well, so that's one of those things where, you know, you can keep learning about that forever, and I am.
Good.
And a group of us got together, and we decided to help the state of Connecticut make some use out of the Beckley Furnace, which they had purchased in 1945 under the encouragement of one Charles Rufus Hart, who was a civil engineer that I passed away long before I had a chance to meet him. He got the state to buy the old iron furnace on Lower Road in East Canaan, but the state really had neither the inclination nor the resources to develop it. And the furnace almost collapsed, but a local group spearheaded by Ed Kirby and some Canaan residents got together and formed the, Fred Hall in particular, formed a committee to save the furnace. And they formed in the mid-1990s. And were able, with some help from our politicians, get some money set aside to stabilize the furnace and take the vine, get the trees off it that were growing out of it and on it, and turn it into a real asset in the park system. Well, times haven't changed much. The state of Connecticut has the inclination, but not the resources to really operate that. So we formed a nonprofit, and a bunch of us old gray-haired guys take care of that site. We make sure that the maintenance is done, that the grass is cut, the brush is kept at bay. And on Saturdays in the summer, we keep a crew there to help people interpret the site. So we'll explain to them what they're looking at, what happened there, how it was done, and what the impact that activity had on the rest of the country.
And having been on that tour, it's a wonderful tour.
Because one of the things that people are surprised to learn, first of all, a lot of people can't imagine there was an iron industry in Connecticut. But then when you tell them what the product was that came out of that furnace, it was railroad car wheels. And they were good railroad car wheels. They usually lasted longer than the cars they carried. And think about the time frame. Barnum Richardson started doing that in 1840, or 1830, really. What's going on in America between 1830 and 1900 is the westward expansion. Well, that's being carried out on top of wheels made in Connecticut. And certainly not exclusively, but
pretty much.
The best wheels that went the farthest and wore the best were made here in northwest Connecticut, and they were carrying the freight west. So this silly little town had a lot of impact on the development of the country. And, of course, longer ago, not a topic for today, was the Arsenal of the Revolution, where we played a, a pretty substantial role in the formation of the country.
I think that's going to be part two.
Maybe, yeah.
Thank you so much.
You're very welcome.